afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Sam Roggeveen, Director of the International Security Program here at the Lowy Institute. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and paying our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. And I'd like to welcome Ian Morris. Please give him a hand. Welcome him. Ian Morris is a historian and archaeologist and holds Stanford University's Jean and Rebecca Willard Professorship in Classics. And this year he's in Australia. He's been honoured with the appointment to the Australian Army's E.G. Keogh Chair for 2019. And I'd like to acknowledge Al Palazzo, Dr. Al Palazzo in the front row here from the Australian Army Research Centre, who's made this event possible today. Thank you, Al. Professor Morris has published 14 books, many of which focus on the evolution of human society and the factors that have driven major transformations throughout history. His most recent publications include Why the West Rules for Now, War, What Is It Good For?, Conflict and Progress in Civilization from Primates to Robots, and Foragers, Farmers and Fossil Fuel, How Human Values Evolve. It's fair to say, Ian Morris, that Australia's rather preoccupied with China at the moment, and that's our subject here today. Much more than Brits are, I assume, at the moment.
Thanks.
You've got other things on your minds. But look, let me just quickly, just to set the scene here, scan the headlines of the last few weeks. I know you've been in the country for a couple of weeks now, and you've got a sense of the temperature of the China conversation. Just from the last few weeks, you'll recall there was the incident of the Australian swimmer who refused to share a podium with a Chinese swimmer over a drug scandal, and that took on kind of geopolitical dimensions. Chinese spy ships shadowing Australian military exercises. The visit to Australia of the US Secretaries of State and Defence, with the attendant rumours that Australia might host US missiles with enough range to hit China. Of course, we've had the Hong Kong protests now going on for several weeks. And now, just last weekend and today, Prime Minister Morrison's attendance first at the Pacific Islands Forum and today a bilateral visit to Vietnam, both in our major newspapers being read through a China lens. So clearly the temperature is high at the moment for the China conversation here in Australia. And so I wanted to talk to you about your perspective on China, of course. And we were talking just upstairs just a moment ago about another book that you're writing, and you referred to the long-term perspective. And I said, well, what does that mean? And you said, well, roughly the last 8,000 years. And I said, around here at the Lowy Institute, we think of the long-term as something like 30 or 40 years. But let me begin by asking you, because this is your specialty, talk about China in the long-term perspective. What is the single most important factor behind China's rise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the things we were talking about upstairs is that one reason why historians make themselves so unpopular is that they will give interminable answers to simple questions like this. And after 2 hours of talking, you still don't know what the guy is saying. But on this one, I think there's a one-word answer on this. And the one-word answer is just geography. The geography has been driving driving this whole story that we're looking at. And when I talk about long-term, actually this book I'm writing about the British Isles over the last 8,000 years, that's short-term. Long-term, anything less than 15,000 years, you're wasting your time. Because I tend to think that the big patterns driving history, they tend to be forces that mostly emerge at the end of the last ice age, about 15,000 years ago, as the world starts warming up. That kind of created the geostrategic context that so many of our current issues are still deeply embedded in. And so so when I talk about geography, I got interested in this question about the rise of China about 15 years ago. Historians were arguing about it a lot. Because for many, many years, the default position among historians had been, well, the West is just somehow better than everybody else. Whether it's because of Christianity or democracy or just like some people would still say genetic factors. Western European people are biologically superior to the rest of the planet. And so if you believe that, then this whole thing with Japan and China, this is a real problem. This should not be happening. And so historians kind of broke down into these two camps. One saying, oh, well, the default position for the world is that Europeans are the best and are going to dominate the planet. And something weird and wacky happened in the last 50 years, and it's sort of temporarily gone off the rails, but it's bound to come back, Western domination of the globe. Others were saying the default position is East Asia has always been one of the great centres of civilization, wealth, power, innovation, and so on. And the world is going to head back into that sort of position, and people in the West just have to suck it up and get used to it. And so I decided I was going to study this and try to figure out what was going on, and that it was only by looking on this very long term that you would see what the big driving forces were. And so I sort of threw myself into this, spent a long time on it, had a really good time doing it. But the conclusion I came to is that geography over the long run, and continuing to be the case, geography has been the big driver of history. And at one level, pretty much everybody would agree on this. You know, if you were born in Central Australia, or if you're born in New York, City, or if you're born in like Florence or somewhere, your lives are going to be completely different because of where you're born. And everybody understands this. But the other side of it, I think, is, well, if this one word answer that drives the whole of history, why is history so confusing and messy? Because I mean, obviously it is. And what I felt I concluded from looking at this long-term history was that geography drives the story of the development of different parts of the world. But at the same time, development drives what the geography means. And so what your geography means depends entirely on what level of development your society is at. But that, in turn, is driven by the geography. This sort of circular back-and-forth process that produces these very complicated, very varied outcomes. But in the long run, the geography has always been the driver, I think, right through the story. But the story, yeah, complicated because geography keeps changing what it means.
So make this concrete for us then. Why did the West... why did Western modernization, industrialization happen... And why didn't industrialization happen at the same time in the East?
Yeah. And I mean, like all of these things, you can respond to that at different levels of abstraction. But the kind of the most abstract version of this is to say, well, the end of the Ice Age, the world starts war. Everything I ever say begins well at the end of the Ice Age. This is no exception. End of the Ice Age, the world starts warming up, of course, because that's what ends the Ice Age. And the warmer world, this drives the evolution of different new kinds of plants and animals, different places around the world. And many of these new plants and animals, in the warmer environment that the planet's now got, it becomes possible for humans to domesticate these plants and animals. By the way, biologists, when they talk about domestication, mean intervene in the genome, alter the genome of these plants and animals in ways that benefit the species doing the altering. And so genetically modified organisms, we all get worked up about this. But this goes back, like everything, to the end of the last ice age. Basically, everything any of you eat, I don't care what it's labeled, it's a genetically modified organism. So different parts of the world, you've got different plants, wild plants and animals out there, some of which can be modified in ways that increase their yields for humans by just a few little genetic tweaks. Others are much more complicated. Some places have dense concentrations of these things. Others have very thin concentrations. What we now call the Middle East has far and away the densest concentrations. And so that's where farming begins first. Writing these books got me much more than I had to do before. It got me thinking about, well, what is human nature? What is it that humans do that makes us distinct kinds of animals? And it seemed to me that humans are pretty much the same everywhere in the world. And obviously, we have different skin colors and there are genetic differences, of course, but basically, the animals are more or less the same. And that's why domestication begins in the place where domesticable plants and animals are most densely concentrated. And so that's where it happens first. And so before 10,000 BC, in what we now call the Middle East, people are domesticating plants and animals, yields of calories going absolutely through the roof, populations getting bigger and bigger, new challenges being thrust on people by the new meaning that geography takes on after the Ice Age. So people in the Middle East are the first ones to start living together. in villages of hundreds of people, towns of thousands of people. New kind of collective action problems are pushed onto them by this, which they solve by same solution that almost everybody in the world finds eventually, which is very hierarchical solutions with kings that you think might even be gods. And you start to invent cities and states, writing, all these things. And all of these things are invented independently over and over again around the world. But later, because people start down the path later. So like China has an independent agricultural revolution, but about 2,000 years later than the Middle East now does. And so like the Middle Eastern end of Eurasia, it starts getting all this stuff, these more sophisticated societies, a couple thousand years earlier than they do in China, slightly earlier than they do in India, earlier still than they do in Africa. Africa has its own independent agricultural revolutions. So on around the world. It's like you can think of it as a race if you want to, but people starting off down the racetrack at different times. Mm-hmm. So the big, really abstract 10,000 year story is western end of the old world gets a head start. So all of this stuff happens earlier. And you know, a big part of the question in my Why the West Rules for Now book was why, like you were saying, why does the East Asia not have an indigenous industrial revolution? Because it's only the industrial revolution that gives Western nations the power to the ability to project their power really globally. So why did that happen in Europe, not in China? And my guess, because I get a little bit into futurism in the book, but you're always guessing. But my guess is that if something had happened to derail the Western Industrial Revolution, drag it back by a couple hundred years, say, that you would have actually seen an independent industrial revolution in East Asia. So it's just kind of a matter that the West got this head start. But getting from the end of the Ice Age to now, a lot of stuff happens along the way. There's a lot more complications in it than that.
So it's fair to say that I think your argument at least reduces, maybe even minimizes entirely, the role of human agency in all of this, and certainly of great leaders. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, to return the conversation to China, the fact that in China's growth occurred when it did was surely down to the fact of Deng Xiaoping and a few others in the Politburo who made an in-principle decision that what we've done before is no longer working, this has to change, now we're doing this other thing.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the many things that struck me as I started, because I didn't start off writing and working on this at a large scale. It's something I moved into. I'm in my late 40s. But as I started off down this path, I realized the sort of stuff I'm now doing, looking very long term, very large scale, this works better. That like the higher the level of abstraction and generalization you go, the better it works. And so if you ask a picture question like, you know, why does the Industrial Revolution happen in Western Europe rather than East Asia? I'd like to think my book gives you a pretty good answer to that. I mean, it might not be the right one, but it's a pretty good answer. If you start zeroing in, though, and you say, why did the Industrial Revolution happen in England first, not in Belgium or Northern France? There, it's like the lower you get into the weeds, deeper you get into the weeds, the more details you get, the more other factors start to matter. And so, like you could 100% agree with my explanation for why the Industrial Revolution happens in Western Europe, and yet you can still say, but it could equally well have happened in Belgium, if just a few, or Northern France, if a few other things had gone differently, if the English had lost a few more wars in the 17th and 18th centuries. It could very well be in northern France that it had happened. So it's like the more detailed the question you ask, the more the individuals matter. And with Deng Xiaoping, yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree. You get somebody different comes out on top in the post-Mao struggles. Things could have gone very differently. There's nobody kind of running the rules of the game telling the Chinese they must open up to the world and must become part of the global economy. They don't have to do that. They can decide not to do that. And then they pay a price because they've made a huge mistake here. And again, for me, the obvious analogy here is, say, like with Spain in the 17th and 18th centuries, with the first discovery of the Americas, Spain is ideally placed to dominate the new North Atlantic economy that's emerging. Spain really ought to have become Britain, but it didn't, because Spanish rulers didn't want to become Britain. The British and Dutch leadership finds out really quickly, you know, if we want to maximize this new Atlantic economy, we've got to open up our society and allow the merchants to do all these weird merchanty things they do, which make all the money. And the scientists, you've got to let them get on with it, not keep telling them God disagrees with you, so we're going to burn you at the stake now. The more you burn them at the stake, the less quickly the whole thing goes. And the Spanish rulers were just, like, the assumption the British and Dutch are making are, is that our slice of the pie is not necessarily going to grow, but the pie is going to grow, so we will actually get more overall. And the Spanish rulers are not willing to go down that path. And so they steadily fall further and further behind from about 1650 onward. And same principles, I think, applied in East Asia. The Chinese leadership did not have to do the sort of updated Britain. It could have done an updated Spain, but they don't. They jump on board and throw themselves into these massive transformations. And there's no guarantee that China will continue to be able to exploit these forces that it's taken control of. Japan, famously, early 90s, Japan enters this period of economic stagnation. Similar or worse could well happen in China. But the larger story about the increasing involvement of the eastern end of the old world in global markets and integration, that's not going to stop. If you get poor Chinese leadership that drives the bus off a cliff, well, you've still got India. You've still got Southeast Asia. This process is going to carry on, I mean, I think, almost regardless of the clever or stupid things our leaders do.
So that's what I want to ask you about next. But I also want to just say that I'd like to open this up to all of you in just a moment. I'll ask one or two more questions, but please have your questions ready. What I wanted to ask you about next was on that very theme about, you know, this inexorable trend of wealth and power moving from the Atlantic to the Pacific, essentially, if we wanted to reduce it to its essentials. There is a pretty fertile debate now in the West generally about the decline of Western institutions and the decline of liberalism in the West, and that this is, in a sense, abetting the rise of China and even of other authoritarian states such as Russia. Personally, I tend to think that's a little overwrought, and there's that's another side of that debate. But if I understand your argument correctly, you would say that in fact that entire debate is beside the point. Whether Western institutions are more fragile than we think, whether Western liberalism is in decline, and we're feeling, you know, generally as democracies, not as happy with ourselves as we used to be, less confident, that's really beside the point. The larger forces of history are going to be moving east anyway.
Yeah, I guess I would say a sort of yes and no answer, I think, on that one. We should get a standard default position of the academic, a little bit of both. The yes and no, the yes, in which I think, yeah, that sort of is what I'm saying, is that we have seen this sort of thing happen over and over again in the past. As development changes, geography takes on different meanings, new opportunities and problems arise in different places. And a lot of the time it kind of, it's beyond the power of the leaders of societies to avert this altogether. You can speed up and slow down processes. You can inflect the lines of the trend lines, but actually turning the thing around. I was thinking about this in the last chapter of Why the West Rules for Now. It seemed to me the first person in history who could claim to be a great man in having the sense of being someone who could actually have turned around the trend lines in history was John Kennedy, who had the power to get into a nuclear war that could potentially have destroyed all of the great powers. Prior to that, I mean, really nobody, I mean, ever actually changes, single-handedly changes the paths of development on this large scale. Again, the further you get down into the details, the more you can say you've been a great person and a changed course of things. But so, in one sense, yeah, absolutely, agree completely with what you say. In another sense, I mean, a bit less so, in that what I think is going on, the way that, like, institutions and cultures mesh with the sort of vast impersonal forces side of things, is that different stages of development, different geographical forces, they create worlds where different kinds of institutions and values work well. And, like, democracy, I think, is a really good one to talk about. I talk about it a little bit in my last book that I did, The Foragers, Farmers and Fossil Fuels, one that you mentioned. I was looking there, one of the things I was looking at was ideas about equality and egalitarianism and so on. And it seemed to me there's, like, really three times in human history you can talk about democracy being a powerful and important institution. And one is the first 95% of human history. I mean, it now looks like we evolved something like our modern form about 300,000 years ago, a bit earlier than we had thought. And this goes on to about 5,000 BC, when, or to 10,000 BC anyway, once again, the end of the last ice age, everything answered by that, where everybody in the world, people are living in really quite small groups of people that are very, very egalitarian. And from 19th and 20th century studies of surviving groups of this kind, Stone Age technology groups, the explanation seems to be really clear. It's that egalitarianism is the only thing that works. It's almost impossible in a hunter-gatherer band to make yourself Louis the 14th. It is impossible to make yourself Louis the 14th. It just can't be done. And so, of course, we're all egalitarian. And when we start farming, it's like that completely flips upside down. And it's no coincidence, it's not just an accident, that every recorded farming society in history has been very hierarchical, extremely patriarchal. They've all practiced forced labor, slavery, serfdom of some kind or another. All of the bigger ones have had a ruler that they think is in some way greater than human. And the extreme case, of course, the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, who literally were gods incarnate, walking among us here on earth. And of course, this survives into the present day. I mean, like Queen Elizabeth II is queen by grace of God. That is the official decision. It's the grace of God. She has been anointed with sacred oil that makes her superhuman. She is closer to God than you or I. And I actually met Princess Anne for the first time recently. I did not feel I was in the presence of God, although she was extremely good at her job. I got it, how she does that day after day after day, talking to people like me, I just don't know. But no, very good at her job, but yeah, not so godlike. But of course, 1,000 years ago, that would have landed me in a world of trouble saying that. Maybe it still will. But it certainly would have 1,000 years ago. But now, it's really hard to believe your rulers are closer to God than you are. Like when George W. Bush announced that he was going to talk to God every time there's a big decision, it generated a certain amount of merriment in North America when he said this. And the democracy, you had the prehistoric version. Then for very, very special reasons, it comes back in a very modified version in the ancient Greek city-states for a couple of hundred years and goes away again. And now we've got this modern version that has come about overwhelmingly since the industrial revolution kicked in, where once again we enter this world where more egalitarianism just works better. And nobody makes any country go down the path toward democracy. But the more you've done so, the last 200 years, the more you've done so, the better things have basically gone for you, which is why Australia is doing slightly better than Afghanistan. But nobody's going to make the Afghans go down this path. They don't want to. They don't have to. But they pay a price for it. And I think the big question, I mean, coming back finally to the books that I wrote, I think the big question for writing these sorts of books is, well, so what happens next? I mean, the 21st century, most people seem to agree, is going to see bigger changes than any earlier period in human history. Is one of these changes another swing so that a more centralized, authoritarian, autocratic decision-making process is actually going to work better in the 21st century, particularly perhaps one massively enabled by technological developments, by machine learning, artificial intelligence, and so on? Is it possible that the Chinese are right, that their form of organization is actually going to capture the positives out of this new technological environment better than our democracies? Because half the population in every country thinks their democracy is terrible. It's sort of almost written into the assumptions. So, and I mean, I don't really have an answer to that. I mean, I have some guesses that I do think that is toward the sort of technological, more centralized thing that may well be the way we go. But I think it's a totally open question.
Yeah. I'm going to open it up after this question, but I wanted to ask you about US-China relations, and clearly that's for Australia and I think for the world now, the most important bilateral relationship in the world. I think if we accept your grand theory that at the highest possible level, human agency can't really interfere with these large-scale, multi-century trends. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think it's also true to say that individual nations and individual leaders seek to resist those trends at various times. Mm-hmm. What are then the prospects for China as the rising power and the United States as the status quo power? Are those two countries fated to actually clash over leadership in Asia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Actually, coming back to the human nature thing, because I am just obsessed with this at the moment. I've become fascinated with chimpanzees over the last few years. I think most of what you need to know about humans, you learn by looking at chimpanzees. And I guess increasingly the way I feel about this is somebody asked me to talk about human nature. I tend to say that human nature is extremely important in this story, and human agency extremely important in the story, but the most important bit of it is what we all share as humans, rather than the individual decisions and quirky things we might do. It's what we share as a kind of animal. That's what's driven our story and made it different from the rest of the animals. But yeah, I mean, the current batch of chimpanzees in business suits who run our countries.
Excrement across board tables.
Which is pretty much what it is. We can talk now, as opposed to just throw the excrement across the board tables. My feeling is that the 21st century is going to see this inexorable shift of wealth and power across the Pacific Ocean, increasing importance of East Asia in the world. What we'll face as leaders, is basically just the new version of the same old problem the leaders of political units have always had, which is how do I push myself up to the top of the pile or position myself kind of on the slopes below the great actors and powers. And again, the chimpanzee things, this is what chimpanzees do too. There's a wonderful book called Chimpanzee Politics, which I recommend to everybody, about how chimpanzees form coalitions and work things out. It's great. It tells you everything you need to know. And I think that the challenge is going to be figuring out what is the way to maximize the good outcome, however you define that, for your country, given the changing geostrategic scene, which, of course, this is always what leaders are trying to do. Should it be attempting to contain or even turn back the growth of Chinese power? Because I think it's within the capability of leaders to do this, at least for a while. People often say, well, so what do you see as the prognosis for the United States as the world's number one power? It seems to me we should expect the US to remain the top of the pile for the coming generation, quite possibly for the coming two generations, but very possibly not for the coming three generations. So there's going to be things American leaders can do that speed up or slow down the shift in power. And the same with other players around the world. Like obviously for Australia, this is a huge question, dominates everything else. And there's going to be skillful and unskillful ways of playing this game. I mean, just like when Britain becomes a dominant power in Europe in the 18th to 19th centuries, Frederick the Great plays this beautifully. He's a terrible, terrible human being, but really good at this. And other people, Louis the 14th, yeah, not so good at this. So I think there's all kinds of things that can be done. That's, of course, then you're coming way down from the 10,000 meter view that I generally adopt, down into the weeds where actually knowing something starts to become important.
Okay. Let me open it up to the audience, and I'd invite you, we'll start at the front here in the second row, just state your name and ask your question.
Hi, my name's Stilgherry, and I'm allegedly a journalist. you alluded to Western colonialism there before without saying the word colonialism, but I've heard that oversimplified as the Spanish kill everyone and take the gold, the Dutch trade with them, the British had settler colonialism and so on. Where does China's current worldview fit into that with Nine Dash Line, Belt and Road, and a Blue Water Navy?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting way to put it. I have to be honest. The knuckle dragger view of colonialism you just gave us, I think, is not entirely wrong. I mean, this is kind of what happened. The Spanish think the Atlantic Ocean is there as a quick way to get to places full of gold that you can kill everybody and steal it. And the British and the Dutch think exactly the same. But unfortunately, they're looking for gold in all the wrong places. And there's all these wonderful letters written back by people in Jamestown at the beginning of the 17th century about, we're going out again tomorrow looking for the gold mines. And they're still looking for the gold mines now. It turned out no gold, no spices, none of this stuff. And so they said, well, damn, we're going to have to figure out something we can grow and sell. And it turns out that tobacco, wow, this is great. And so eventually, of course, this turns out to be a bigger engine of wealth and growth than the gold that the Spaniards have got. But the Chinese fitting into this story, yeah, I mean, one thing I encounter quite a lot in my day job in a university is this attitude of the students. There's something uniquely evil about the Western world because it's colonialism and we've taken over so much of the world. Chinese are not like that. They're better. They're more peaceful. And seems to me when you look back across the long-term history of the expansion of the states, Eastern and Western states have behaved in astonishingly similar ways. And China gets to you get to have a China the size it is now because you had colonialist regimes running it for thousands of years. And they conquered and colonized all the people around them on land. It was a bit more difficult to go out by sea from their position than it was for the Europeans. So they tended to have less in the way of overseas colonial empires. But still, Taiwan becomes part of Qing Dynasty China. They tried to conquer Korea at various points. This same sort of stuff has been going on for a long time now. And I think the world that we live in now, who knows how long this will go on, but forcible, changing international boundaries by force has been pretty much off the table since World War II. And as a lawyer pointed out to me a couple of years ago, I hadn't really thought about it this way before, that the last time the international community more or less signed off on a violent change of international borders was in 1948 with the Arab-Israeli War. And then by 67, of course, they've already changed. 19 years, that was enough. You can't do that sort of thing anymore. And so obviously Taiwan is the kind of the gorilla in the room with any kind of discussions like this. Who knows what's going to happen over that? But yeah, I mean, with things like the nine dash line stuff and the island chains, seems to me China is just doing what great powers do. And rightly or wrongly, a lot of the Chinese officials I've spoken to perceive the island chains as being attempts by the United States and its allies to constrain China's economic power and weaken its geostrategic position. Rightly or wrongly, this is what they think. But I think it's perfectly understandable that they would move to act against that. Perfectly understandable that Americans are not too thrilled about that. And the Belt and Road Initiative, obviously, again, like all these things, a lot of different things going on here. But I do think American strategists are quite right to say that this is an attempt to outflank the island chains and come out down in the Indian Ocean in a different place. And I was at a conference in Kazakhstan in November, which was really cool. I've never been to Central Asia. This is great. I went to this conference in Kazakhstan. There was this fantastic knockdown fight between an American strategic analyst and a former prime minister of Pakistan about what the Belt and Road Initiative meant. And it was just so illuminating to hear it from the other side about the way people in the, not the Pakistan, a small country, but the relatively smaller countries in South and Central Asia were looking at this. So my take on it is just that China is behaving in the way that all great powers, all rising powers have always done. And I think they were very, very clever about this, at least up to 2008, with expanding their position, strengthening their position, strengthening their trade, without directly ever challenging the United States' global dominance. Since 2008, and I know opinions vary on this, I mean, seems to me that since 2008, they've become noticeably more aggressive in the face of the Americans. And of course, people in 2009 started saying this thing that in 1989, capitalism saved China after Tiananmen Square. In 2009, China saved capitalism. And to the extent that that's true, you can kind of understand why, I think, understand why Chinese leaders might start becoming a bit more assertive and aggressive about their claims. Where it's going to lead, I mean, obviously that depends on the next sets of leaders.
It certainly helps save Australian capitalism, that's for sure.
All right, thank you. Name is Jack. I have a question. What do you think would be the end game of today's discussion about China? And for instance, would you say China would be become more westernized and more democratic, and in order for continue to cooperate with the West, or would China stay this way and cooperate with the West continually as it does today? And if it's the second case, could you talk a little bit about what does that mean to Hong Kong and Taiwan, those areas where with closer geographical and political ties with China?
Fascinating questions. And I guess I tend to feel that studying history rarely gives you answers to current questions. What it does do is show you what sort of questions you should be asking. And sometimes it helps you ask the questions in a better way that's more likely to lead you to be able to come up with answers. And so I guess with this question about the westernization of China and the easternization, if that's a word, easternization of the rest of the world, I mean, it seems to me there's kind of two big things things you can see happening in history that, again, don't answer the question, but help at least help me think about it. And one is just saying, well, okay, we've seen this kind of thing many, many, many times before, going all the way back to rise of the Roman Empire, the Han Dynasty in China, the Mauryans in India, the rise of a great power dominating a region. And we've actually seen the same pattern at the cultural level, intellectual level, seen the same pattern every single time, which is when you get a great power arising, as well as hard power, it generates enormous amounts of soft power. People start to like the great power. They start to imitate the great power. They want to buy the great power's stuff. And again, you see this in all these cases, like the Roman Empire, probably the one I know the most about, but way beyond the Rhine and Danube frontiers of the Roman Empire, Germans are buying Roman wine and dressing in Roman-style clothes. And we know that because you wrap yourself up in all these robes and then you pin them with these special kinds of bronze brooches that we then find in the graves. We can map the spread of these things. They're trying to look and act like Romans. And you see that in southern China with the rise of the Han Dynasty and so on. This seems to be just and it's a bit depressing in a way, but it's kind of a universal thing. It's like Stockholm syndrome. We start to emulate the people who dominate us, which is very depressing. But 100 years ago in Europe, you see all these Europeans complaining about the Americanization of European society. And of course, they're completely right. This is exactly what's happened. So that line of thinking, that way of looking for analogies, suggests we should expect to see a lot more Confucius Institutes out there in the near future, and people learning Mandarin, which they're already doing in the fancy high schools in California now. They used to learn French, not anymore, they learn Mandarin now. We should expect to see a lot more of this. The other way of thinking about it, though, is to say, well, what sort of thing works well at different times? And in the last 200 years, like I was saying earlier, the last 200 years, the more a country has gone down this path of liberalization, the better it's functioned in an industrial globalized economy. The more they've tossed patriarchy out of the window and women have come out of the house working in the paid workforce, and the more they've started tossing out all the old religious prejudices and saying, yeah, the world actually will not end if we allow Jews to own houses. My God, a radical idea. It was radical, of course, in the early 19th century. But the more you go down that path, the more you flourish within the sort of modern, industrialized, internationalized context. And again, we've got, I think, this great question. Is that going to continue to be the case in the 21st century as things change? And my sort of sense of what Chinese leadership has been trying to do is to find this sort of golden spot where they've liberalized enough to open up their economy and make all this wealth and so people aren't going to starve anymore. But they haven't liberalized so much that you get like the rise of middle-class political actors like you got in Europe in the 18th and in America, 18th and 19th centuries, demanding the sharing of power. The attempt here is to find this narrow path where you have all the benefits of liberalization without what the rulers of a centralized state would perceive as being the drawbacks of it. And I guess the Hong Kong thing, I think, does fit fairly squarely into that. And I mean, I spent a bit of time in Hong Kong. I really like Hong Kong. I think it's a great place. But I'm by no means an expert on Hong Kong. But I heard a couple of really interesting things, actually, on this current trip to Australia. And on the one hand, one set of people have been saying that, well, the whole reason China's getting a little bit antsy over Hong Kong is to send a message to Taiwan. It's not really about Hong Kong at all, it's about Taiwan. And the message is, we have an expectation for how things are going to progress and how the reintegration of the Chinese, ethnic Chinese world is going to go. And if you don't go along with this, look at what's happening. We are really serious about this. You need to sit up and take notice of this. And the other interpretation has been that this is actually not the intention at all, but that the Taiwanese are taking a message from this, which is that if you go the way Hong Kong did and reintegrate with the mainland on a voluntary basis, look what happens. Is this what we want? And of course, again, my impression is that, as usual, nobody knows what the answer to these things is, but it's going to be wound up. The Hong Kong thing is going to be one of the big things people look back on, I suspect, 50 years from now, saying this is one of the turning points.
Would China behave very differently on the world stage if it was a democracy?
I would be tempted to say no. frankly. I think it might be a bit less efficient at it if it were a democracy. I mean, the thing with democracy, there is trade-off you make. You know, democracy is a terrible, terrible way to do anything. And then Winston Churchill has his famous line, it's democracy, worst political system ever invented except for all the others. And it's this terrible way to do things. We elect all these incompetent criminals constantly and put them in charge of things. But we don't shoot each other very much. I mean, we do a bit, but not very much, at least compared to authoritarian states. With the authoritarians, you know, Mussolini made the trains run on time, but he kind of shot a lot of people too. A lot, not as many as some, but he shot a lot of people. It's a trade-off that we make. And again, looking at the long-run side of this, my impression is that authoritarian regimes can be very, very effective. But what they're not good at doing is pooling the wisdom of entire societies. And based on the principle, we can pick out a few people who really know what's going on. And if you actually believe your king is a distant descendant of a god, of course, you know who to pick out to run things. And if it happens that it is actually reasonably straightforward to see what the big things that need to be done are, then authoritarian regimes can be really effective. It's when you've got big challenges and questions, though, which we've consistently had for the last 200 years as the world has been changing so fast. On the whole, they've tended not to be so great at that.
Let me take another question and just note that inevitably in these situations, having chaired a number of these things, that the male hands always go up, and I'd be happy to see female hands go up as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Eleanor Kirillova from Austrade. Thank you for your remarks.
Thank you.
We've heard from over the years about Tibet and its desire for independence. More recently, the world's been hearing about the Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. Do you see a time in the future where China as empire will start having more extreme internal conflicts? Or has it been too completely homogenized under the Maoist regime for that to ever happen?
Yeah, I guess my impression, again, this is something where my sort of long-term perspective on things, I think, is probably not, doesn't give me any particularly great insights, except in a very abstract way. I mean, my impression of what is sort of currently going on is there's still a very long way to go to persuade people, a lot of people in the western parts of mainland China, that they really want to be part of China. But again, I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room who know a lot more about contemporary Chinese things than I do, and would be able to say much wiser things. The long-term perspective on this, though, is that I think we're seeing Tibet, Xinjiang, other Western provinces. This is just normal. You know, this is what empires do. When the Roman Empire starts off, Rome is one city, a few thousand people initially, and it expands out across Europe. And it takes, and the other bits too, it takes many, many centuries for Romanization as a process to really do much. But by about the 4th century AD, by the time this has been going on about, you can start the clock at different points, but at least 600 years by this point. Now, yeah, probably if you had time machined your way back to Syria or time machined your way back to Britain around the year 300 AD, probably you ask people what are you? Probably Roman is the first answer you're going to get a lot of the time. It takes a long, long time. And China, again, when the expansion of the Han Empire, roughly the same period of history, you gradually get people in southern China, which is where the changes happen most slowly. Gradually, though, they start saying that they are Han. They are part of China. And then in both those cases, Rome and the Han Dynasty, the empires collapse, and the whole thing goes back into reverse. And the political units break up, and you get the rise of more localized identities again. So I mean, I would say what's been going on is just part of this much larger story, with the caveat that everything happens faster now. Not fast enough for the European Union. I think that's been the great tragedy of the EU, that it signally failed to persuade almost anybody, I think, that they are Europeans as opposed to British or French or whatever. But I think the abstract high-level picture, this is the way these things work. Violence creates larger political units, which generate soft power, which draw people in, and then they fall to bits.
Hi, my name's Ian Lynn. I'm a strategic futurist, and I run a company called Quovadis. Where are you going?
It's a good name.
Now, the way we decide where we're going is to start off from history. So I talk about combining hindsight with insight to get foresight. Okay. And from foresight, you add imagination to create a future. And in reality, you create a future every day of your life, because what you do or don't do today creates your future. But if your perception of your future is only from the past, okay, what happens if your perception is wrong? That's your life. So if your perception is wrong, then all your decisions today will be wrong. Okay. So I look at stuff. As you see, I'm Chinese. I was born in Australia, okay. My parents migrated here in 1928 in the middle of the White Australia policy. Now, going back in the history of Australia, the Chinese were responsible for the Federation of Australia. You say, how come? Well, 1850, the gold rush. And who rushed here? A lot of Chinese. So did Westerners. The problem was that the Chinese culture was different from the Western culture. The Chinese, all right, still work harder, and that's just part of their culture.
Can I ask you to work your way towards a question?
Okay. My question is this. I believe that there will be democracies, and I believe that Australia has the best possibility of creating what I call cyber democracy. That is, as a nation, we're at the level where we have all the information, all the knowledge, but not yet the wisdom. Okay? I believe that China would not have gotten where it is today had it been a democracy. If you look at what's happened in China in the last 30 years, starting from nearly zero, okay, and it's caught up with those 200 or 300 years that it missed out right in the beginning. So okay. I believe there's things that are going to be totally new in the future, depending on the country and the geography and the culture. Mm-hmm. Okay, I find myself being the token spy wherever I go in Australia today, because they the Chinese, okay.
But so that's you're not asking the right Ian answer. About cyber democracy. Is
I'm
that...
asking about a whole new type of democracy called cyber democracy, okay, with a educated population, right, can decide on what it wants and democratically get there. Our particular democracy today is not a democracy at all. Right? As large corporations look very, very short-term to get as much as possible for themselves.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Is there something called cyber democracy coming up in the future?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I want to say I like your thing about hindsight, insight, and foresight. One of my side jobs is I write monthly columns for another strategic forecasting company, Stratfor, and they see very much the way they think about things. And I guess it seems to me if you're looking at history as a guide to where things might go, which I think, we all do every day when you get out of bed, you make assumptions about what's going to happen today based on what's happened to you on previous days. You kind of know vaguely what clothes to put on and this kind of stuff. Because of experience, you get a couple of things from looking at the history when you're thinking about the future. And the first of them is the potential of identifying what the big trends and processes have been over time, and trying to figure out what the explanations might be, and then using that to project forward. Say, well, what's likely to happen if current or recent trends continue? But then the other thing you always see is that in the past, every single trend has been derailed at some point. Things have gone off the tracks. And very, very often, the very forces that generated this trend in the past turn out at a certain stage of development to be the things that undermine it, which is basically what Karl Marx said as well. And so one of the big things you can learn about the past is that it is constantly happening, that the past ceases to be a guide to the future, because the processes are changing things so much that the old lessons of the past no longer apply. And with the cyber stuff, I think this is one of the wild card is an overused expression, but it is one of the wild cards in the deck. I think almost every strategic analyst I've talked to thinks that technological change is one of the major driving forces in the relatively near future. And, you know, my obsession is about how geography and development interact with each other. And of course, the technological change is a big part of the development process. And one of the things technology has been doing ever since humans were around is shrinking space and changing the meaning of geography. And so in a couple of my books, the question I end up with toward the end is, you know, are we now entering a period of time when development has reached such a level that it is effectively making geography cease to mean very much at all? And, you know, to get here last week, I had to get in this tin can and fly for 15 hours across the Pacific Ocean, which felt like a very long time. But if Captain Cook had had one of these Boeing things, boy, he would have liked that. That would have made everything very, very different. And, of course, cyber is one of the ways, one of the most powerful forces for shrinking and annihilating spaces that we have ever created. In a sense, at least, we're kind of already at the point you can communicate with people anywhere in the world virtually instantaneously, call up knowledge from all over the world virtually instantaneously.
And at no cost.
I mean, close to no cost. Yeah, as close as doesn't matter anymore. And all my buddies in Silicon Valley, where Stanford University is, they tell me we have not even scratched the surface yet. This is going to, within even the lifetimes of somebody as broken down as me, this is going to change profoundly before I die. And there's this one guy, Ray Kurzweil, who I'm sure many of you will have heard of, who has this saying that he is going to live long enough to live forever. That he's convinced if he can just hang in there, his brain can be scanned on a neuron-by-neuron basis, beamed up to the great database in the sky, where he'll fuse with the rest of humanity in a gigantic superorganism with trillions of times the thinking power of all of humanity combined. And at that point, of course, arguing about democracy sort of slightly becomes beside the point, I think, when we get, if we get there. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know any more than anybody else whether there is such a thing as a viable cyber democracy. You know, my computer appears to know more than I do about where I want to go on vacation already. So maybe this is kind of the way things are going. But I think the one thing we can be absolutely certain of is that the transformations of the 21st century are going to dwarf everything that has happened in the last 300,000 years, which is kind of, I think it's kind of exciting.
Sobering and exciting, yeah. It strikes me that we've had this tremendous, a wave of optimism that probably peaked around 2011 about what the influence that cyber would have on global politics. I picked 2011, the year of the Arab Spring, when we thought Twitter and Facebook was going to undermine autocracies in Egypt and in Iran and Syria and other places. Of course, it didn't happen. And then soon after that, we started getting much more information about the success, seemingly, that authoritarians were having, particularly in China, in suppressing the internet, in basically allowing for its benefits to be used, its economic benefits to be used, but for nevertheless maintaining control over political commentary online. I just wonder where. So we've gone from that tremendous optimism to now, I think, great pessimism. I was in an audience like this during the week. Earlier this week, where someone asked a China analyst about, you know, the success that the Chinese were having with controlling the internet, and I couldn't help thinking, if that question had been asked 10 years earlier, it would have had the exact opposite emphasis. It would have been all about how the Chinese are going to withstand this tremendous liberalizing potential of the internet. Mm. So where do you stand on that?
With so many of the questions, I don't know is the quick answer, but. You know, I mean, the only real expertise I have on things like this is by thinking about similar sort of things going on in the past. Yeah. And I think we've seen this sort of process go on again and again. I say the Industrial Revolution is probably the best analogy for what we're going through now, you know, partly just because it's relatively recent, so there's quite a lot of documentation about it, and also because within such a short space of time, it really did transform what it was to be a human being. And there you see this same sort of waves of optimism and pessimism about what's happening. And often, like we see in the 21st century, tied to larger political perspectives. So like in Britain, at the heartland of the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, you know, conservatives generally tend to see all the what they perceive as incredibly negative forces about this change. It's corroding all of the old ways we did things. And often the same things will be interpreted as negative, the same changes interpreted as negative by more conservative thinkers and positive by more radical liberal thinkers. So things like the ability of people to move around the country. This is strikes a lot of conservatives as a terrible thing. You're breaking down all the old kinds of hierarchies, you're merging these distinct cultures, and sometimes it's very explicit, you're top down, we are the power holders in the southeast of Britain, we don't want all these nasty northerners coming and getting in our faces. Other times it's a very nostalgic thing, that the old rural communities are disintegrating. You get, of course, all these great 19th century English novels about the breakdown of the rural community. Whereas on the whole, the more liberal, radical guys are saying, yay, great, this is exactly what we want, people moving around all the time, all the old ties of deference and hierarchy are fragmenting. This is fantastic. Places like Liverpool and Manchester and Birmingham are becoming the big new centres. This is all great. And it just doesn't seem to me that different from what we are going through now. And it is, I mean, I find looking, one of the most useful things I found I learned to do when I was writing Why the West Rules for Now is to look at what people in the past have thought about the future and what they got right and what they got wrong. So I think we're about as good or bad as this as people were 200 years ago. And it's like if you look at something like Jules Verne or H.G. Wells, I love these guys, and you read their science fiction things written 100 years ago, and a lot of it is just really silly. And that's what tends to grab your attention, the slightly lunatic things that seem to us now that they said. But then you step back and you think, well, what about the broader brushstroke of what they're painting? I think by and large, they were kind of getting this, a lot of this, at least, getting it right. And so, yeah, I've taken to reading science fiction again, which was something I hadn't done much since I was a teenager. I think it's incredibly illuminating, not because these guys are getting anything right necessarily, but for just opening you up to think more about possible outcomes and so on. So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's all up in the air. We should not be surprised that there's both good and bad wrapped together in these developments, because they're always has been good and bad wrapped together in every single development in the entire history of the planet so far. So it'd be a little surprising if this were not the case. I am rambling now. Last thing I'll say. Year before last, I went to a dinner with Eric Schmidt, the Google guy, and he's sitting there talking, and several of us there were historians, we're talking about stuff, and he actually says, he now, looking back of the vast expanse of 7 or 8 years, he cannot believe they could ever have been as naive as they were. They seriously never occurred to any of the Google people that you might use technology for what they consider to be bad causes. It's like, wow. You know, if you wanted an argument for why we still need historians in the world, I think Eric Schmidt just gave it to us.
We have time for one more.
Thank you so much. I'm Karan Dimich. I'm at the ANU. It's been wonderful to hear from you, even if every answer did come down to the Ice Age. you talked earlier a lot about how individuals find it. It's hard for individuals to reverse trends. They might make it quicker or slower and so on and so forth. Going back to China and maybe other countries as well, you see kind of a concentration of power in certain individuals, in China's case, Xi Jinping. Could you talk a bit more about historical precedents when such power has been concentrated, of a vast empire or a vast country, powerful state, in one or two people, and how that has moved on when they have collapsed or when those individuals have passed away, and if there's anything that we can learn from there?
Yeah, that's another interesting question. Because of course there's been lots of examples of this sort of thing. Many, many, many autocratic empires. Many of them, though, again, this is not something I've thought about systematically, so I'm kind of making this up as I go along, so you'll completely be forgiving. For my own reading about assorted great tyrants of history, I've constantly been surprised how often the great tyrant turns out not to be the Wizard of Oz guy pulling the lever behind the curtain, making everything move. How often there's what political scientists will sometimes call a selectorate around there. You don't have an electorate electing you to power, but you have a selectorate, people who have effectively selected you as the dictator or emperor, whatever you are, and people who have the power to deselect you as well if they want to. So like some of the famously autocratic Roman emperors, well, they're surrounded by the Praetorian guards who've helped put them in power and keep them in power, and who can stab them under the rib cage anytime they want to. And so you're always operating with some kind of coalition around you, negotiating with them. And What I often find myself wondering about, reading biographies, actually Hitler, I got obsessed with Hitler. Shortly before the chimpanzee phase, I had a Hitler phase. With Hitler, growing up as a little boy in Britain, most of the people in my parents' generation and beyond them, they were all still living in 1940. They had not moved on at all, and everything was about World War II and Hitler. The picture you would get of Hitler is he is this autocratic man dominating completely this totally obedient, efficient German war machine, which we, by our pluck, grit, and sense of humour, single-handedly defeated, and then all these other countries showed up. And it turns out, shockingly, that actually wasn't the case. One of the things that really struck me was how, in certain ways, a lot of historians are now saying how little power Hitler had over things. Once things got going, of course, Hitler is not personally building Messerschmitt 109s or something. It's all got to be done by somebody. And the question, a number of historians don't like counterfactual questions, and I'm sure you're aware of this. You don't like saying, what if? You just say, well, I work on what actually happened. I don't think about what could have happened. But the question regularly comes up is, well, what if one of these many attempts to knock off Hitler had actually succeeded or something else had gone wrong? What happens then? And there's all these other guys. And some of them out there, yeah, there are guys in the Wehrmacht who are seriously interested in getting Hitler out, negotiating with the Allies and so on. But there's a heck of a lot of not. And there's many good reasons to think it's at least possible that even in an extreme case like Hitler's Germany, you knock off the top guy, what you get? You get another top guy. You don't get Justin Trudeau showing up. In Nazi Germany. It doesn't work that way. And so I suspect, and again, I don't know the details, I'm sure, as well as a lot of the people in this room do. But if Deng Xiaoping had not sort of headed things off in the direction that he did, or Xi Jinping not in the sort of his own version of the direction, there's at least a good chance you would have got somebody doing something very, very similar. And of course, there's no certainty. People could have tried all kinds of things. Might have been better, might have been worse. But I think the default assumption should always be that it's difficult to jolt a government out of the path of development it's on, the track it's in. And that other things being equal, you're probably going to get somebody plodding along in a very, very similar kind of direction. But as I say, it's not something I've thought about systematically. Now, it would make a really interesting subject for kind of large-scale study, the degree of constraint on tyrants.
Well, Ian, my counterfactual is, what if all of us hadn't showed up here today to listen to you talk? And I think we'd all be a little worse off than we are right now. So thank you very much. And would you all thank Ian?
Thank you. Thanks very much.